This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear about the push to reopen the Alex Oda case. We're joined by Arab American civil rights attorney Abdin Jabara, who talks about the political assassination of the leader in California of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. It occurred 28 years ago, but so far, the FBI has sat on its hands. We'll also speak with Bill Ayers, author of his new memoir, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. We welcome Bill to the studio and are pleased to have him read sections of a very well-crafted and thoughtful book.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I want to share with you this quick update on the new city councilwoman in Seattle, Washington. Seattle is normally a town of Microsoft billionaires and the Democratic Party. But last week, Kshama Sawant, a socialist, won a city council chair. She ran on a ticket of increasing the minimum wage to $15, to tax the rich for education, to put in rent control so people can afford their rents, and a number of other progressive issues. Hundreds of people poured out and volunteered for her campaign. There were leaflets and signs up all over Seattle. $110,000 was raised for her. Unions, which normally had voted Democratic and supported the Democratic Party, switched over to her. And she won a majority. We congratulate Kshama Sawant and all those people who recognize the importance of that campaign. And we tell our listeners, keep your eye out, because this is going to be something that's going to happen more and more often as the problems of this country with unemployment and poverty and war present themselves as something that's bound up with the system and can't be changed unless there's a socialist solution that's put forward. We're joined in the studio today by Bill Ayers, the author of a just-published book, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. It's the second volume of his memoirs, the first being Fugitive Days. Bill became famous in the 1970s as a leader of the Weather Underground. He became a prominent professor of education at the University of Illinois. In 2008, the right-wing media outed him as a, quote, pal of Obama. His memoir, which covers his teaching and his experiences after being outed by the right-wing media, is a terrific book, and we welcome Bill to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be here, Michael. Thanks so much.
Well, Bill, you've written this really wonderful book, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. Will you please read to our listeners to whom you dedicated the book?
Sure, I'd love to. It's dedicated to all those who've kept the faith as they've trudged toward liberation, teaching freedom, saving the earth, resisting the race to incarcerate and the steady descent into a brutal new Sparta. To all the aging radicals and the up-and-comers, the new abolitionists and the old freedom fighters, to the undocumented and the unafraid, to the occupiers, to the everyday people defying oppressive authority and rising in solidarity with the disadvantaged, the marginalized and the despised, the wretched of the earth and our best hope for the future.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. Bill, the title is obviously ironic. How did you get to be both an American dissident and, quote, public enemy?
Well, the American dissident part came pretty naturally. I grew up, you know, in the heat of the civil rights movement. I came of age when the world was on fire, from Africa to Asia to Latin America to the Middle East. And in our own country, it was the Black Freedom Movement defining the moral agenda for the whole nation, and I found myself drawn inexorably into it. The public enemy part, of course, comes from continuing to live a long life as a radical and as a public radical, and not being willing to trim my sails or my revolutionary hopes, dreams, spirit. And come the 2008 election, the national election, I was kind of thrown unwittingly and unwillingly into that national campaign. And it's important to remember this, Michael, that the narrative that Barack Obama palled around with terrorists, or that Barack Obama had a shady Palestinian friend, or the narrative that he hung out with the black nationalist preacher. That narrative was spun by Hillary Clinton long before Palin and McCain picked it up. It was in the spring of 2008, in the heat of the primary, that Hillary Clinton developed that narrative that we don't know much about this charismatic, smart, forward-charging senator from Illinois, but we do know he has these cartoon character friends who are very, very dangerous, and the old favorite American pastime, guilt by association. That's how I became a public enemy.
Well, you identified with the civil rights movement, and that really led into the movement against America's war in Vietnam. And I'd like to ask you, if you would, Bill, to please read to us what you were doing at that time.
You know, I was a kid coming out of a very privileged background. I was a kid coming out of a privileged household in Chicago, a prep school. And I went to the University of Michigan, and I couldn't sleep for about 2 years because the world was on fire, in flames, and I very much wanted to be a part of it. So I'll read a little bit of that period. I was arrested in 1965 in a draft board sit-in with 39 other students, and that catapulted me into something that was unpredictable to me even months before. And I kind of recommend it to young people. I think, you know, everyone ought to put themselves out there publicly on the line for what they believe in, and even go to jail, because you see a different world, completely different world, and you change. Real education. Let me read. So we got busy and invented 1,000 different ways to organize and educate. War resistance mustered mothers and students, lawyers, returning veterans and mine workers, churchgoers, teachers and nurses, and whole communities. Sites of protest included draft boards and induction centers, coffee houses set up outside of military bases, ROTC offices on campuses, institutes conducting secret war research, Dow Chemical headquarters, the Pentagon, and appearances by every politician associated with the administration. The iconic images of the time are true. I took to the streets, marched and picketed and demonstrated, and clashed with the police and the authorities who mobilized to put us down. But they were only part of the story and a fraction of the action. Being arrested, beaten up, and tossed into jail quickly became a commonplace for me and for a lot of other activists. And I felt I could do that standing on my head. But there was so much more to do. We drew up fact sheets, created teach-ins, did research, made spontaneous pop-up theater, circulated petitions, and embraced music, dance, murals, and agitprop. I was in Detroit for 2 years with Vietnam Summer, a concerted effort to knock on every door in working-class neighborhoods across America and meet people face-to-face in order to engage in a dialogue about peace. In a single day, my brother Rick and I were called traitors 3 times, spit on and threatened with physical violence once, and invited in for coffee or cookies 4 different times. One young woman burst into tears and came outside to sit on the front steps with us. Her cousin Kenny, who'd grown up with her, had been killed a month earlier near Hue, and the family was still trying to understand all the specifics of his death and come to terms with their immeasurable loss. She talked and cried and told us stories about Kenny for an hour. Those front door encounters were the most difficult and exhilarating thing I'd ever done. The more I tried to teach others, the more I learned myself about the real circumstances of people's lives, and mostly about me. Step by step, I became more and more radical, conscious of the connections between foreign war and domestic racism to start, between capitalist economic hierarchies and the hollowing out of democracy, between the sexual exploitation of women in war zones to service the military and violence against women here at home. Eventually, I thought of myself as a revolutionary, committed to overturning the whole system of empire, and that was a decidedly two-edged sword. As an organizer, I was learning to listen as well as to shout, but as a newly committed activist, I was fired up and brimming with urgency. The peace movement geared up to end the American invasion and occupation of Vietnam, but as more and more people joined the effort, it seemed possible that we might not only end that single, despicable war, but that we could prevent other such adventures, the invasion of Santo Domingo, for example, which was happening right before our eyes. At a certain point, it seemed to me that African Americans and the working class, and indeed the majority of the American people, stood in direct and deep conflict with the U.S. government, a contradiction that could only be resolved in a second American Revolution, a massive popular upheaval. It was a grandiose dream, to be sure, and a wildly passionate vision. The war engaged me, its brutality and its horror, but the resistance to it inspired me. The sacrifices and steady victories of the Vietnamese, the courage of the anti-colonial forces in South Africa, Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau, the audacity of the guerrillas from Cuba and all over Latin America. Live like Che, we said. Was it naive? Of course it was naive. The Tupamaros in Uruguay were naive as well. So was Che. Did I misinterpret the conditions and the possibilities? Indeed. But who can gauge what's really possible in the moment? You have to try.
That's a very profound thought.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to read so much. I haven't read that in a while. That was fun.
Bill, you wound up going underground. And I wanted you to read for us again a short paragraph when that happened. And then I want to ask you about what you were doing during that time when you were doing work in a daycare center with children.
Sure.
But first, let me ask you to read about when you were underground.
Sure. The Weather Underground was born with an explosion in Greenwich Village that killed my partner, Diana, and two of my close friends, Diana Outen, Terry Robbins, and Ted Gold. So I'll read just one paragraph. But that awful event also announced the existence of something weirdly original and brand new, a group of young, largely white, homegrown mother country Americans taking up arms in opposition to the war. Bernadine Dorn and I, and a wider circle of partisans and fellow travelers, were indicted by the Justice Department on two single-count conspiracies. We had crossed state lines, they charged, in order to foment civil disturbances and destroy government property. Bernadine was prominently placed on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list, an inventory of J. Edgar Hoover's evolving obsessions that was quickly changing right then from a rogue's gallery of plug uglies and terrifying gangsters to a catalog of appealing revolutionaries, Angela Davis, H. Rapp Brown, and Bernadine herself. We were frightened, confused, and uncertain, to be sure, making it all up as we went along. But we were also resolute and had no intention of reporting in federal or state court. Too many other radicals, we thought at the time, got caught in a government trap that deflected their best efforts and reduced their political work to a barricaded defense committee and occasional fundraisers for legal fees. And so we took off, and we lived for more than a decade, on borrowed time, surely, and on the run from the law.
Well, you were living right here in New York on the Upper West Side. You got involved with a daycare center called BJ's Kids. And looking back at it, that was really the launching of your career as a professor of education, quite an influential and distinguished one. But you started off with these little children. And I wanted to ask you about that and then ask you if you'd read us a short paragraph about BJ's Kids.
Yeah, I'd love to read that, but it didn't quite start the way that you think it did. It did influence me deeply and influenced Bernadine and me both, but it actually began, teaching began for me in 1965. I was arrested opposing the war in Vietnam. I spent 10 days in county jail, and there I met a man whose wife had just founded a freedom school, and I marched out of jail into my first teaching job. And that's an interesting beginning, because for me, teaching was always linked deeply and closely with the quest for social justice, with the desire for a better, fairer, unracist world. And so that started in 1965, but I left teaching in 1970, and I did a lot of other things, returned to teaching and to BJ's Kids in 1978 after our first child was born and we were searching for daycare. And yes, then we were on the Upper West Side and we found this remarkable, not formally educated, but amazingly talented woman who's still our dear, dear friend. So I'll write a little bit about finding BJ. Besides the hard work of taking good care of a swelling gaggle of kids, BJ was trying to manage her embryonic small business, juggling a blizzard of part-time schedules and the cash that flowed in and out daily. Tuition was based on an evolving, dynamic, and idiosyncratic hourly rate, unwritten, uneven, and unclear, that seemed to spring spontaneously and fully formed from the head of BJ. My first payday was a marvel. BJ pulled her large shoulder bag from the top of the fridge as I was getting ready to leave and rummaged through the bills, emerging with a handful of crumpled up 20s that she handed over to me. "See if that's right," she said. I couldn't remember what we'd agreed on, but it felt okay, so I said, "Sure, that's fine." BJ's kids had a row of easels against one wall, a cozy reading corner with lots of books and pillows, a dress-up area stocked with hats and flowing scarves, colorful cloths and costumes, briefcases, handbags, cowpoke boots, capes, hats of all kinds, and milk cartons filled with specific items to create a make-believe hospital, pizza restaurant, shoe store, bakery, firehouse, and more. It was a home-like, hidden, and impenetrable place, a place to explore and experiment. And beyond this, there was clay, water, sand, and art materials set up and available in a corner near the sinks, a large collage table on wheels with a series of bags and bins containing bits of cloth, shells, buttons, bottle caps, and corks. For our son Zaid, BJ's Kids was an intimate treasure trove of discovery and surprise, and it was also the honeypot, a place to feast and fatten. The joy began each morning in the biggest collection of wooden unit blocks ever assembled. Build, 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 where Zaid moved in a matter of months from horizontal runways to vertical towers, to bridges, to archways, to entire fantastical worlds complete with characters and action. We earned some early childhood notoriety through what seemed to us harmless enough innovation. We had a large juice and snack table near the sink that we kept stocked and available from the moment the children arrived in the morning until the last one left in the afternoon. The table had little cups surrounding pitchers of juice that kids would pour for themselves whenever they liked, with all the attendant spills and stickiness, and paper plates and napkins for the taking, as well as larger plastic serving dishes with sliced apples, celery and carrot sticks, oranges and bananas, cheese and crackers constantly replenished by staff throughout the day. "Disgusting," said the director of a sister preschool. "You will have roaches and mice everywhere." "This is bad practice," advised another. "The kids will eat all day and never learn the importance of mealtime." None of this had ever occurred to us, and none of it made sense, but we were a bit off balance and unsure at the start. But when a neighbor and friend, a therapist and feminist whose practice focused on eating disorders, this is the legendary Janie Hirschman, encouraged us to persevere, arguing that the main thing everyone needed to learn in relation to food was self-regulation, and that the operating question should always be, "Are you hungry?" The snack-on-demand table became a quirky signature we embraced, and it fit with the larger idea that guided BJ's Kids from top to bottom, from beginning to end. Kids need to be free to develop from the inside out, not the other way around.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about something you've written quite a lot about, and that's the relationship between education, like the kind of education you just described, and democracy more generally.
You know, I think that this is something that in the school reform debates, in the arguments about where we're going as a country and as an educational system, this largely gets lost, Mike, and I think it's central that we foreground it. In my view, education and democracy, even a flawed, imperfect, or aspirational democracy, is based on a precious but fragile ideal. And the ideal is that every human being is of incalculable value. And a country that was founded on the putative idea that we are all equal, we spend an enormous amount of energy trying to find the scientific basis of all the inequality we see around us. That's a fool's errand. And what we ought to be demanding is an educational system that creates free people, people with minds of their own, people who are able to interrogate the world before them and do their best to, you know, find their own pathway. And that means that whatever else we teach initiative, courage, imagination, entrepreneurship, and we avoid teaching obedience and conformity, which are the hallmarks of every authoritarian regime in history. So in Nazi Germany, They had wonderful schools that taught amazing literature and music and physical arts and so on. And they also had a system based on obedience and conformity and doing what you're told and following the rules. That's a recipe for catastrophe in any free society. So what I've spent most of my adult life doing is fighting for an educational system where the fullest development of each becomes the condition for the full development of all, and the fullest development of all becomes the condition for the full development of each.
That has echoes of a famous manifesto.
Yes, it does. And I'm surprised to know that you know the quote. Or I'm not surprised to know, I should say. You know, there are many other ways to approach it. You know, I often think of Steve Biko's famous line that the strongest tool in the master's toolbox is the mind of the oppressed. If you can control the mind of the oppressed, that's what you really need. You don't need guns and tanks, isolation cells. You control the thinking. And that's why, for me, the great model, and you and I have talked about this, but the great model of liberatory education is the freedom schools in the South in the mid-1960s, which were based on a simple set of questions. Who are you? How did you get here? Why are you in the freedom movement? What are you trying to accomplish? And where do you want to go? Those sound like simple questions. But remember, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were all freedom school teachers who were assassinated and lynched in the South precisely because the message of those questions is revolutionary. How did you and I get here? What forces formed us? And where do we want to go? What do we need to change? Revolutionary questions today, just as they were in the mid-60s.
Well, before we bring this closer to the present, I wanted to talk to you about a period in your life with Bernardine that you called Valley Times, and ask you to reflect upon that and share a paragraph in the book on that, please, Bill.
Love to. You know, we got this notion, and Bernardine and I have lived it and quoted it many times. We got this notion from the great Miles Horton, the founder of the Highlander Folk School, who always talked about in a lifetime you'll be lucky if you have mountain times once. Twice is excessive. But mostly we live in valley times. That is, there isn't an identifiable mass movement. It's percolating below the surface, but it hasn't burst forth. And in many ways, what this book is about is moving beyond the mountain times and following a long life over many decades, trying to be true to the values that inspired and got us moving in the first place in very changing times. But I'll read this just a short paragraph. These were valley times, and we dug in. I'm referring now to after 1975, after our kids are being born. Our political outlook was what it has always been, still opposed to imperialism and its evil twin white supremacy, still believing that capitalism had exhausted itself and was in its dying moments and most dangerous zombie stage, still certain that the political class was corrupt and without a single answer to the gathering crises. All of that combined with a strong reserve of romance and idealism, not the dreamy sort, but an idealism edged with pain and urgency, not a barricaded retreat, but a living sense that there are ideals worth striving for in this wicked and wounded world. I was still hopeful for a freer and more peaceful future, a world more joyful and more just than the one we'd inherited. We were also now a lot more agnostic about how to get there, and because we were unsure, Bernardine and I divided up our forces and attended every demonstration, every meeting, and every conference of the left. You take the kids on Saturday, and I'll go to the organizing meeting, she would say. Or I'll take the kids to the swimming lesson, and you go to the conference. Or let's pack a picnic and take the kids to the rally in Washington Square Park. And so it went, day by day.
Well, let's fast forward up into 2008. And being a well-known and accomplished educator, you had all these requests for you to go from one place to another in the United States and speak. Then the right wing started baiting you when Obama was running, and there was some turnarounds on those invitations. And you had various experiences then. Some speeches were canceled, others were encouraged. And I wanted to talk to you about a couple of those because I think they're instructive. You had one situation in Wyoming and then another one in Georgia Southern. And I wanted you to read those paragraphs you wrote about them. First of all, talk to us about Wyoming.
Well, what happened in Wyoming, it was becoming drearily familiar. But what happened in Wyoming is that I had an agreement to give a couple of talks there, one to researchers and scholars and one to a public audience. Shortly before I was to speak there, they were canceled because of a campaign coming mostly through the internet, mostly a very angry kind of threatening campaign. So it was canceled. And I was kind of taking this stuff in stride. But what happened there was that a young woman named Meg Lanker was a returning veteran from the service, and she was a student at Wyoming, and she was furious that they had canceled me, and she went into federal court and sued them. And her argument to me when we talked on the phone was, I'm not worried about your free speech, it's my free speech that's being attacked, because I have a right to read any book I want and to talk to anybody I want. I want to talk to you. I'm not saying I agree with you. I want to talk to you. And she was very courageous and very lovely, and she you know, made me very encouraged just to see how spirited she was. Went into federal court, a conservative judge ruled that I had a right to speak, and they organized the lecture. What would have been a talk to about 25 students probably turned into a talk to 1,500 students on a snowy night. So it didn't have its desired effect. There were many wonderful things that happened when I went there, but I'm just going to read a little bit ahead of where you were. About 1,100 people, I think, braved a snowstorm and came, and that was encouraging. My sister-in-law's father, who was a retired bishop as well as former minister from the United Church of Christ, showed up. He'd driven a couple of hours to stand in solidarity. I didn't recognize him because he was dressed in a dark suit with a clerical collar and a big wooden cross, quite unusual for him. What a great surprise, I said. What are you doing here? The Lord moves in mysterious ways, he said with a wink and a smile, gesturing with his Bible. If any of the crazy Christians get out of hand, the Lord wants me to set them straight. So I loved him being there. And then when I was finally introduced, I could practically feel the letdown in the audience. Who's that old professor wobbling across the stage? And what happened to the terrifying terrorist we were expecting? I had that a lot. I wanted my talk that night to stay true to the original invitation, but with modifications fitted to the changed situation. I talked about the principles of education in a democracy and argued that much of what we call schooling is based too often on obedience and conformity, the hallmarks of every authoritarian regime throughout history. It banishes the unpopular, squirms in the presence of the unorthodox, and hides the unpleasant. There is no space for skepticism, irreverence, or even doubt. While many students long for an education that is transcendent and powerful, I said, administrators like President Buchanan of the University of Wyoming seemed ever ready to police the boundaries of thought, to see that we stayed on track, reducing education to a kind of glorified clerking that passed along all the received and certified wisdom of the day without doubt or question. In Wyoming, the main victims were truth, honesty, integrity, curiosity, imagination, and finally freedom itself. And the wider but hidden victims would include the high school history teacher in Laramie or the literature teacher in Cheyenne, who would immediately get the message, be careful what you say, stay close to the official story, stick to the authorized text, keep quiet, and keep your head down. I told them that there would be times in their lives when they would have to break the rules in order to stand up for justice and humanity, when there would be no court of last resort beyond their own consciences and their free minds, and that it was important to exercise that capacity every day, a little anarchist calisthenics to stay in shape for the big games to come. The young people cheered that line. I finished by evoking Bertolt Brecht's play Galileo, where the great astronomer sets forth into the world dominated by a mighty church and an authoritarian power. Quote, the cities are narrow and so are the brains, he declares recklessly, and he feels himself propelled toward revolution. Not only did Galileo's radical discoveries about the movement of the stars free them from the crystal vault the church dogma insistently claimed fastened them to the sky, but his insights suggested something even more dangerous, that we too were embarked on a great voyage, and that we too were free and without the easy support that dogma provides. Here, Galileo raised the stakes, and the establishment struck back fiercely. Forced to renounce his life's work under the exquisite pressure of the Inquisition, Galileo denounced what he knew to be true and was welcomed back into the church and the ranks of the faithful, but exiled from humanity by his own words. A former student confronting him in the street said that many on all sides had followed him, believing that you stood not only for a particular view of the movement of the stars, but even more for liberty of teaching in all fields, not then for any particular thoughts, but for the right to think at all, which is in dispute. The link was clear, and the warm response that night from the students was encouraging.
It's so beautifully written,
Thank
Bill.
Thank you so much.
Really. Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident by Bill Ayers, who's our guest today. We'll be back after this break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Bill Ayers, the author of the just-published book Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. Bill, let's drop down south from Wyoming over to Georgia Southern University, where you had quite a terrific experience, and I wanted you to share that with our listeners. Let me get you the spot here on the page where you write about it.
Fine. It's, I had so many different experiences, and you've picked two that are kind of emblematic. But at Georgia Southern, I was invited, canceled, and finally rescheduled. And now I'll read. There was a huge police presence and a crazy meandering route through basement tunnels to get me to the stage. As I stepped to the podium, a large contingent of Hell's Angels in full regalia and with Tea Party Patriot patches prominently displayed on their arms shambled in and took the first two rows, scowling up at me. I paused as they settled in, welcomed them, and began. After 40 minutes, the floor was open for questions, and first to the microphone was the leader of the Hell's Angels, a bony Vietnam-era vet named Rooster, with faded tattoos covering his thin arms. "I'm surprised to tell you that I agree with most of what you said," he growled, "but I worry that you're a big government guy." Rooster wasn't sure why he thought that, but he was concerned. And I tried to reassure him. "The main function of any government anywhere is to tax and spend," I said. "And so the only real question is, who do you want to tax? How much do you want to tax them? And what and where do you want to spend the money? You rode up here on a government-built highway. Some of you might even say you took the socialist road. Maybe you thought to yourself as you rolled over those bridges and past the libraries and the sewage treatment plants and the freshwater canals, that was money well spent. I know I think it was money well spent. When Mayor Daley sold the Chicago Skyway to profit-making corporation, the tolls skyrocketed, and the profiteers still got public money and tax breaks, and most Chicagoans were pretty pissed off. What's so great about profit? What's so great about greed? Give us back our Skyway," I said. "I like that," Rooster said, chuckling. "But," I went on, "maybe as a small government guy, you'll agree with me that we should immediately close the Pentagon, save $1 trillion in a stroke." There was a burst of applause. "Not the Pentagon," Rooster objected. "So now you're the big government guy," I pointed out.
Bill, you had a kind of a rounded, multi-sided view of Obama when he was running. And I'm going to read one aspect of it and ask you to read another and then ask you to reflect on it. You talk about him as not only hugely intelligent, but also kind and sturdy and compassionate, a great combination. no one could miss another quality either, political ambition.
Yeah.
And then in another evaluation of him, and this is before he was elected, and I'm going to ask you to read that evaluation.
Let me just say about the political ambition. I used to, Bernadine and I, who both knew the Obamas for a long time, and I would always say, gosh, that guy's ambitious. I think he wants to be mayor of Chicago. And that shows the limits of my imagination, you know. I mean, although some people would say the mayor of Chicago is a more powerful office than president of the empire, but who knows. So here's another little piece on Obama much later in the book. It's on election day, 2008. I was pumped up. For the second time in my life, I was going to vote for a Democrat for president. I'd campaigned for LBJ in 1964, before I was old enough to vote and to know better. Johnson had soured me forever on the whole corrupt mess and illuminated for me the stark limits of electoral politics. And I'd voted in primaries over the years, notably for Shirley Chisholm and Jesse Jackson. But in general election, I had a devilish time choosing to vote for one of the greatest war parties ever built in the history of the world. I typically voted Green or Socialist if either had a candidate on the ballot, or more often wrote our son Malik in, who would have been a far better president at the age of 14 than any of the others. And I always found something on every ballot to support wholeheartedly. I voted for Bruce Wright for judge in New York because he set reasonable bail for poor black men charged with crimes and was derided by the police association as "Turn 'em Loose, Bruce." Once I opposed a prison bond initiative that was defeated by a tiny handful of votes, only to be reversed by the governor of New York, who magically found money for prison construction, and reversed again when our brother-in-law Haywood Burns brought a lawsuit which delayed it for years. I could only stand to vote for a National Democrat once before, in 1972, when I voted against war and for George McGovern. Now I would happily and without any illusions about him vote for Barack Hussein Obama. All during the campaign, Senator Obama had described himself as a moderate, pragmatic, middle-of-the-road politician. The right responded in full-throated attack that he was in fact a secret Muslim and a closeted socialist, some kind of Trojan horse and Manchurian candidate rolled into one to destroy the country. While the left said, in effect, "I think he's winking at me." He wasn't winking, and his self-description turned out to be absolutely accurate, perfectly matching his record in Illinois and in the U.S. Senate, if anyone had bothered to look. He was super smart, personable, compassionate, and decent in many ways, all true. He was also a mainstream moderate, as advertised, prepared to sit on the throne of a now declining empire and command its violent legions.
Bill, you and Bernadine are active in Chicago in an organization called ARC. Tell us what that organization is and what you've been doing there.
Well, you know, most of us, speaking of Valley Times, those of us who are radicals, who still think of ourselves as revolutionaries, living in difficult times, living in dark times, and times that are much darker for many, have to find ways to become movement builders. That's how we think of it. Movement building is on the agenda. And what we mean by movement building is bringing folks together who are working in various fields to change the frame of the discussion, to change the frame from how many prisons do we need to prison abolition, to change the frame from healthcare as a market to healthcare as a human right, just to take two random examples. We have to change the frame in the issues we work on, but we have to find ways to talk across issues if we're going to build a social movement. My own view is that while we can't will a social movement into being, nor can we sit quietly and say, well, I'll know what to do when the social movement springs onto the ground fully formed. It never works like that. Think of the civil rights movement, which we witnessed and participated in. That was percolating for decades, and people worked to build the kind of consciousness, to study, to learn to talk to one another, and so on. So that's what we do in ARC. We are a collection of academics and artists and radicals who meet together to try to bring together forces for peace, forces against white supremacy, forces for queer rights, forces for education as a human right, and so on, and find ways to create forums and activities where we can participate together. And I often think that one of the revolutionary acts of a time like this is learning to talk to one another so that when the moments come, we will know who we are.
We've been talking with Bill Ayers. New book, Public Enemy, published by Beacon Press, just came out. Bill's on a speaking tour across the country. If you're thinking about getting a holiday present, I'd like you to think about getting Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident by Bill Ayers. Bill, before we let you go, you have any final thoughts?
One of the things that occurs to me again and again is that these are valley times, but I feel the mountain times creeping up on us. I feel the pushback and the resistance. And we see it all over the country and all over the world. On, for example, environmental crisis, we see all kinds of spontaneous fights back from China to Russia to Greece to Spain to the United States and El Salvador and Mexico. These things could spread like a wildfire. We have no idea, no way to predict. And a lot of people get cynical and say, and feel powerless. And they feel, a lot of us on the left, a lot of progressives, feel barricaded. And I have never felt that way. I feel that we are in the majority, not only in the world, but in this country. If we have a vision of peace, a vision of participatory democracy, a vision of justice, we're in the majority. Our task is to tap that majority and organize it and be prepared when the trumpet sounds. I often refer to Rosa Luxemburg's wonderful letter from prison, where some of her comrades write to her during World War I, and she's in prison for resisting the war. And they say, "We don't know what to do without your leadership. What should we do?" And Luxemburg writes back and says, "First of all, stop whining. Whining gets us nowhere. Secondly, you have to learn how to become a mensch, M-E-N-S-C-H, Yiddish, for human being, basically." But she says to her friend, "I can't define for you what a mensch is, but a mensch is someone who gets up every morning and loves her own life, enjoys a bottle of wine and a good meal with friends, marvels at the sunrise and the sunset, is willing to take care of the kids and the elders. But a mensch is also someone who puts her shoulder on history's wheel when history demands it. Spend your days trying to figure out how to love your life and love the world, because action is a great antidote to cynicism and passivity."
Bill Ayers, you are truly a mensch. And thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. And thank you so, so much for writing Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident.
From one mensch to another. Thanks, Michael.
On October 11th, 1985, prominent Palestinian American civil rights leader Alex Oda was assassinated by a pipe bomb at his office in Santa Ana, California, where he was the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee's regional director. Now the FBI and the Justice Department are being urged to renew its investigation into this political murder. Very quickly after the killing, the FBI named the Militant Jewish Defense League, or JDL, and its outgrowth, the Jewish Defense Organization, as the focus of its investigations. Yet more than two decades later, no one has been questioned or indicted for Oda's murder. Today we welcome back civil rights attorney Abdin Jabara, who helped found the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. He joins us to talk more about the reopening of this 28-year-old case. Abdin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
It's really nice to see you, Abdin. I remember this horrific case of the assassination of Alex Oda. I remember it very well. You were at the time the vice chair of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, and we had discussed it then, and I did some work on it actually with you, which we can talk about later. But the astounding thing that we've just found out, that the FBI claims they've never closed the case and under some pressure now to accelerate their, quote, investigation of this murder. And I wanted to ask you for an update on where things are at.
Well, the situation as it currently exists is that, as you indicated, the FBI says that the case has not been closed and that it's an ongoing investigation. But we're talking about 20 years after the fact, 28 years. Congresswoman Sanchez from Orange County, California, from the 46th District, wrote a letter to Eric Holder and to the FBI requesting some closure on this case, and she got back a very unsatisfactory reply in which they said that the case was still active. she has joined with several other Congress people, John Conyers of Michigan, and other congressmen, to ask for hearings in the Judiciary Committee of the House on this case. It's unconscionable that this case has lasted this long and there have been no convictions of anyone in this case. There have been many ups and downs in the case since Alex was killed on October the 11th of 1985. Several people have been arrested and imprisoned, but not for the assassination of Alex Oda. One of the very positive things that has happened is that the immediate past president of the NAACP wrote an op-ed piece, Ben Jealous, that compared the Alex Oda case to the Medgar Evers case, which, as you know, Medgar Evers was killed in the South by the White Citizens Council, members of the White Citizens Council, and it took 30 years to solve his case. And when asked why Evers' case and Alex Oda's case has taken so long, he says, quote, "A residue of discrimination gums up the wheels of justice in bringing cases to a close. It would be foolhardy to believe the police and prosecutors are all completely immune from the bias of discrimination that leads some people to believe that some lives are worth less than others."
I would even go further than that. Alex Oda was a father. He was a civil rights activist for civil rights for Arab Americans in Southern California. He was a poet. He was, by all accounts, a kind and gentle man. And he was assassinated, a political murder, by an outgrowth of the Jewish Defense League called the Jewish Defense Organization. That was a notorious group in those days. So it was quite obvious where to look. And I remember when you were the vice chair of the ADC, you asked me and another fellow attorney and comrade of ours, Jim Lafferty, who's the head of the Lawyers Guild in Southern California now, but at that time was working with me in New York, and you had gotten a tip from a prisoner in Rochester who claimed to know something about the assassination of Alex Oda. And you asked me and Jim if we would fly up to Rochester and interview this prisoner and find out what he knew. So we did. He was serving a life sentence for three murders, this guy. I won't mention his name because I don't want to get into trouble. But he was quite a well-respected personage in the prison, actually. And the reason was, as an Orthodox Jew, he had litigated a case to get kosher food into the prison. And therefore, the food was also halal, and the Muslim prisoners were grateful to him. So when Jim and I walked into the prison, a number of people came up to us. They welcomed us. Can I get you a chair? Can I get you something from the vending machine? They rolled out the red carpet for me and Jim, and we sat down opposite this prisoner. Let's call him Ron. Ron told us that he actually knew who killed Alex Oda. He said it were two people from the Jewish Defense Organization. They had called him up for consultation on how to prepare the bomb that was used to assassinate him. So Jim and I listened very carefully. When we got back to New York City, we called up the federal prosecutor here in New York City. And 2 days later, we met with him at a restaurant in the Village. And we told him what we knew. The guy was extremely friendly. He said, "Oh, I'm going to try to help you. I like what you guys are doing. I knew Bill Kunstler," he said. "I roomed with Kunstler for a weekend up at Harvard for a continuing legal education course. And I'm on your side on this, and I'm going to go to my superiors, and I'm going to tell them what you've told me, and we're going to accelerate this investigation, and we're going to help." Well, that's the last we ever heard from him, and that was 28 years ago. So it's encouraging for me to hear that this congresswoman in Southern California has taken up the cause, that Ben Jealous issued that statement, that Congressman Conyers is behind it. And I wanted to ask you, what kind of information do you think is going to come out? What do we want to happen here? You know, what was the Jewish Defense Organization up to in those days? And what can we find out from this investigation with respect to, I would say, the hypocrisy of this government in pursuing real terrorists?
Well, let's look back historically on this. The JDL was created in 1968 by Meir Kahane, and it engaged throughout the 70s and early 80s in a number of actions that were primarily directed at Russian interests in the United States, as they were attempting to put pressure on the Soviet Union to allow emigration from Russia, give exit visas to Jews to go to Israel. There were attacks on the Mosiev Dance Company here, on the Bolshoi Ballet. Shots were fired into the residence of the Soviet ambassador to the United Nations. There were a number of such incidents.
Yeah, Saul Hurok, who was producing that, his office was bombed by them, and I think a secretary was killed.
Yes, a secretary was killed. So there were a number of those incidents. They also, however, targeted Arab Americans. And in December of 1985, William Webster, who was the head of the FBI, said that Arab Americans had entered a zone of danger. And our chairman of our organization, Jim Aberrisk, was contacted by the FBI and was told that he, myself, and two other individuals had been placed on a hit list by the Jewish Defense Organization. And we had to take certain security measures because of that information. Since that time, prior to the killing of Alex Oda, there were a number of incidents. We had our regional office in Boston burned. Two police officers were injured when they were attempting to dismantle a bomb there. We had attacks on our office here in New York City. There was attempts to enter it, and a number of telegrams, threatening calls, all types of harassment was occurring on a daily basis. And then Alex Oda was killed. He left three beautiful daughters and a widow in Orange County, and they are active to this day, and his brother is active to this day in trying to maintain the pressure to keep this case alive and bring justice about. Now, there was arrests in Southern California of two people in 2001, Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel. They were charged with conspiring to set off a number of bombings of a mosque in Southern California against a U.S. congressman who was of Arab American background, Daryl Issa. And that case, Irv Rubin committed suicide before that case came to trial. And Earl Krugel said that Irv Rubin had told him the names of who was involved in the killing of Alex Oda. The FBI has not released those names, but Sammy Oda, the brother of Alex, has said that they are, in addition to Irv Rubin, Robert Manning, who is currently in prison in the United States, sentenced to 30 years for a mail bomb that killed a secretary of a business associate of one of his confederates. The other two people that Sammy Oda implicates is a Keith Fuchs and an Andy Green, who are currently residing in the Israeli settlement Kiryat Arba in the West Bank. So my understanding from the materials that I have perused is that the Israeli government has not been cooperative with this FBI investigation. The FBI has not been over there to interview anyone, and they have not requested extraditions in this case for reasons that only they can tell us. So the fact that this matter has gone on for 28 years and that the FBI says that it's an open case is not very encouraging, because I have an article here from the New York Times of July 17th, 1986.
Yeah, share that with us.
Yes, it says, FBI moving on blast laid to Jewish extremists. And the byline is by Stephen Engelberg, and he says, this was at a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee. I can tell you, and this is Buck Ravel, who's the assistant director of the FBI, I can tell you that substantial progress has been made and that a definite investigative focus has been established, he said. In other words, we have suspects in this case and are pursuing those suspects. This was shortly after the murder. And today, despite the fact that he says they have investigative leads and they have definite evidence, they've done nothing on this.
Seems to me that you could say that some prosecutions are politically motivated and others are not prosecuted for the same political motivations.
Well, I think Ben Jealous's statement about how some lives are more important than others in terms of prosecution is exactly on point. The fact of the matter is Arab Americans have no or little political power in this country. And as a consequence of that, they cannot really mount the kind of push to get the closure in this case that would bring some sense of relief and to the community. Because this is the biggest act of terrorism against an Arab American that occurred here, although there were a number of other ones. I mean, we had people here in New York beat up, bones broken, etc., during this period. So I think that there is a possibility of movement, and we need to have people alert and continuing to press for a closure in this case.
How would listeners lend their support to prosecuting these genuine terrorists here in this country? Well, what can they do?
Well, I think one of the first things they can do is to contact Eric Holder's office. Eric Holder is the Attorney General of the United States. The FBI is part of the Justice Department. The FBI is responsible for investigating these cases, and he can make certain that this will take some precedence. Our chairman of the ADC 2 years ago approached Holder about this, and Holder said, yes, they would continue to pursue this, but we have not seen any real action on this.
I want to go back to something you said before about how Arab Americans in the United States are particularly powerless. I would think that that situation has been exacerbated, really, since the attack on Iraq, since 9/11. Arab Americans and Muslims, more generally, have been just vilified just for existing. I'm afraid that that's an aspect of this whole inability to bring to justice the murderers of somebody 28 years ago.
Well, let me just read the final paragraph in this article in the New York Times that I cited before from July 17, 1986. The hearing today was held by the Subcommittee on Criminal Justice of the House Judiciary Committee with focus on violence against Arab Americans. Other witnesses before the committee told of what they believed to be a growing pattern of violence against Arab Americans, which they said was aggravated by the portrayal of Arabs by news organizations and the entertainment world as terrorists bent on killing Americans. I think that this captures it all. This is how first Arabs prior to 9/11 and Muslims since 9/11 have been vilified in the media and in the entertainment industry in a way that helps to create a climate in which these attacks occur.
Well, Abdin Jabara, thank you very much for this update on the Alex Oda case. We're going to be checking in with you, and we hope to interview you where you can give us some good news that they're actually going to do something about it after 28 years. Thank you, Abdin, for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook. ¶¶